You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous planet, thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. I'm delighted you're here, no matter where you are. And we always have a special group of people joining us, and that would be those of you who are joining us for the very first time tonight. Welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. In the news, NASA has postponed their planned mission to Mars. It was planned for 2009. It's been put off till 2011. And the reasons at the core of that decision seem to be cost overruns and engineering problems. So they've put that off till 2011. Let me ask you a question. What do you know about the history of America? I bet what you know is that Asiatic nomads came across the ancient land bridge into what we call Alaska, and then they sort of spread out across the continent, becoming the tribes of individuals that we know as American Indians, Native Americans, First Nation peoples. But the question is that the truth? Is that what really happened? Are there facts to which we have not been exposed? Is it possible that the Chinese were here thousands of years before Columbus? Is it possible that there's evidence the ancient Egyptians were here thousands of years before Christopher Columbus? Well, if those things are true, and we'll find out tonight, but if they are true, the question then is, why have these facts been kept from us, and why is there resistance to you knowing these facts? What's up with that? Why is there a lid on information? Why is there an information embargo when it comes to information about prehistory, the ancient world? Well, my guest this evening is Frank Joseph. Frank Joseph is the editor of a publication called The Ancient American, and he is the author of a new book called Unearthing Ancient America. He's going to join us after our first break, and we are going to talk about what is in the evidence. We're going to be talking about what does the evidence say about the real history of America. Frank Joseph is well known. He, through his publication, has been educating people all across the world with information and evidence about prehistory. And you know, here on this show, we've talked about the possibility that there were, in fact, giants alive, living here in the Americas. We've talked about the possibility of an ancient city that was found in the Grand Canyon. We've talked about where does all that evidence go? How is it that people find these things, it makes the news, and then they just disappear. Well, we're going to look at all of that tonight as we talk with Frank Joseph. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I stated earlier, my guest this evening is Frank Joseph. Frank, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you very much, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here.
I just finished today reading your book for the second time. And I read it when it first arrived. And then we talked, and I scheduled you for the show. And I just before calling you, I had read it again for the second time. And it's fascinating stuff, I have to say. And you've got a lot of great illustrations in there. And it's not just drawings. It's pictures of some of the artifacts that have been found. But let me just kick this off by telling you also that I have read Ancient American a couple of times. I've taken a look at that as well. And it's quite a publication. And it's really, really got a lot of information in it. And both your publication, of which you are the editor-in-chief, and this book, Unearthing Ancient America, really kick status quo history right in the teeth.
Nope.
Have you encountered any difficulties as a result of doing that?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for your very generous words, and we put a lot of work into all the issues that come out of Ancient American, and this particular book was a pleasure to put together, because I'm really not responsible for the majority of the material that's in there. It's a collection of what I hope is our most interesting articles that have appeared in Ancient American over the past 15 years. And it's really flattering to hear that you read the book not only once but twice, so you probably know more about it than I do. There's an awful lot of material in there. It's hard to remember it all. But to get back to your question, is that have we kicked the establishment in the teeth? Well, we're not out to do that. That sounds rather a dynamic way of fighting our supposedly scholastic enemies, but no, we've had a strange thing happen, I can tell you, Kevin, that's totally unexpected. For the past 15 years, since the magazine was launched back in the early 1990s, more than 15 now, of course, the establishment, mainstream archaeologists, completely opposed our position. The big difference between us and them, as it would be, is that we take the position that Columbus cannot be... he can't lose his status as a great explorer, but he was last. He did not discover America. He was only one of many people who discovered America over centuries and thousands of years. And that this continent has been impacted by people from Asia, from North Africa and Europe and other parts of the world for thousands and thousands of years. And they left their trace, their mark here. They made a big impact on our prehistory, and they contributed to what we are today. Mainstream archaeologists say no, there is a line in the sand, nobody was here before Columbus, absolutely nobody, except the first people that wandered over that land bridge from Alaska about 13,000 years ago, nothing before or since then. Columbus was first, that's it. However, there has been a marked change on the part of the establishment archaeologists. Our last issue, our most recent issue, is made up in almost entirely of material that was sent to us by that bastion of mainstream archaeology, the Field Museum of Chicago. They, on their own, sent us a wonderful collection of photographs we've never seen before, sent us a lot of wonderful descriptive materials, written materials, and they've asked us to promote one of their shows that are going on at the museum. So I think there's incredibly a rapport beginning to develop at long last between so-called amateurs or avocational archaeologists and the professionals. And that's because there has been such an overwhelming amount of material which shows that there was an impact made by others long before Columbus, that even the mainstream archaeologists, not all of them, or even the majority now, but some of them in their top upper ranks are beginning to come over to the idea of what we call cultural diffusionism, which is the diffusion of other peoples and other cultures, that the oceans of the world were not barriers to ancient man, but rather highways, and that the contributions made to America are something that needs to be acknowledged. You yourself talked about giants in America.
Yes.
Well, there's no doubt about that. The very first civilization in America, and there were four before ours that rose and fell, the very first one were called the Adena. And the Adena were a people who excelled 7 feet, were over 7 feet tall. And this is not a matter of conjecture or channeling or anything like that. The skeletal remains of these people have been found in some profusion, and it can't be denied. So these are some of the issues that are addressed in Unearthing Ancient America.
All right, let me ask you about the Adena. You said that we have found lots of skeletons of the Adena, and that they were they excelled 7 feet in height. Where are these skeletons?
The skeletons are still preserved. Some of them still are. I should qualify this to explain to our listeners who the Adena were. About 3,000 years ago, about 1,000 BC, up until that point, America had been, at least the Ohio Valley, had been a rather mostly uninhabited place. Then suddenly, 1,000 years before Christ, there was an inclusion of a large population of a completely different culture than anything that had ever been seen in North America before. These were not Native Americans in the sense that they were hunter-gatherers. These were people in possession of a civilization. They had iron-working furnaces, foundries. They introduced agriculture to North America for the first time. They loved growing raspberries. They were tremendous sailors. All this is known. They built stone pyramids. Some of their mounds still exist. And when these mounds were excavated of this great civilization, a peculiar thing was found right from the beginning. And the first excavators, by the way, were treasure hunters, farmers, who thought that these magnificent structures might contain treasures. Well, they did contain treasures, but not gold or silver. They contained wonderful treasures that told us about this great people. They're called the Adena because we don't know what their name really was. It's an archaeological term after a farm where the first Adena mound was recognized about 120 or 30 years ago. And they really were probably called something like the Alley or the Aleg, because the name Allegheny, which we know, the Allegheny Mountains, was named after these people. It's a Native American word. Various Native American tribes referred to the Allegheny Mountains because that's where these people, called the Aleg or the Alley, lived. And in the excavation of the very first mound in Ohio, a very strange thing was on the Adena farm. A strange thing was found is that the skeletal remains of the people that were found inside, very few, were well over 6 feet, which was in contrast to the native population. And then a subsequent unearthing of other Adena mounds revealed individuals that were 7 feet and more. I think the tallest individual, although this is in dispute, but the tallest individual was 7 feet 4 inches tall. Now, these were not bones of people who had become, their remains had become disarticulated over time. That's a process that can happen. As the body falls away, the bones sometimes have a tendency to disarticulate in such a way that the skeletons look bigger than the person's really was. No, this is different, because the cranial remains were in keeping with a person who was 7 feet and more. The women also were around 7 feet, not quite as tall. The women were commonly 6 feet eight, 6 feet seven, but the men would be around 7 feet or taller. This is not the majority of the Adena people. The majority, they appear to be also tall, 5 feet nine, maybe 6 feet, but an upper stratum, what appears to be the aristocracy or the leaders of this society, were commonly well over 6 feet, 7 feet, and more. So by the standards of the stature of the Native Americans, these people would have definitely be considered giants.
Well, someone that's 7 feet four is a giant. Even today, I mean, I'm 6 feet tall, actually just over 6 feet tall. And if you put someone that's 7 feet tall beside me, that's only 12 inches taller. But the overall mass of that body is it's a whole lot bigger than me.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And these people were robust. They were they didn't suffer some kind of degenerate disease or some endocrine imbalance, some metabolic imbalance. That these were people who, over the course of their civilization, which lasted a long time, was founded around 1,000 years before Christ, and it persisted all the way its last manifestation, which on the East Coast, strangely enough, collapsed about 700 A.D. So these people lasted 17 centuries. It's just remarkable. Other civilizations rose and fell while they were still around, as a matter of fact, like the Hopewell civilization. But these people were definitely well in excess of 6 feet. There is a fellow by the name of Dragoo, D-R-A-G-O-O, who back in the 1950s was the first mainstream archaeologist to say, hey, look, these people really did exist, that there really were seven-footers here. And he was, of course, opposed by his colleagues. But now it's accepted, although not talked about, there was a race of giants which was not only here in America, but they were also the first civilizers. They were the first people who lived in organized villages. They had agriculture, as I said. They were the introduced agriculture. And it's a remarkable story. They also built stone forts all through the Ohio Valley. They were a remarkable people.
So where are their skeletons today? Where could we go see them?
I don't believe that you can go see them because we're dealing with very fragile materials, especially organic materials that are 3,000 years old, some of them, they existed between 1,000 B.C. and 700 A.D. So I don't know where you could see them. The best way to really learn about them you don't have to take my word for it, is in a mainstream book. Our listeners can go to the interlibrary loan and look up a fellow by the name of William Dragoo. And his books describe it. He talks about one mound particularly, which was very interesting, in which the archaeologists found the remains of four human beings that were laid out to the four cardinal directions. And these four human skeletons were not particularly large. They were about your size, about 6 feet, which is substantial, or less. I think they were like around 5'9" to 6'0". Kind of average, but one of an additional skeleton laid out not according to any direction was 7 feet one or 7 feet 2 inches tall. And that's in Dragoo's book, so he's a mainstream archaeologist. They don't teach this in the schools, of course.
Well, and the question is why? Why don't they teach this?
Well, it's the best way I can summarize this without making an entire program about it is that the dilemma of American archaeology is similar to the dilemma of the UFO experience. Now, these two are unrelated, I think, but the dilemma is that the system, if you want to put it that way, or the establishment, the government, whoever you want to group it as, has been denying the existence of UFOs for, well, over 60 years now. Although they can't possibly exist, it's all a hoax and so forth. But with evidence now that can be brought out to show that, yes, indeed, there is good reason to suspect that there are people visiting us from other places, they would have to go back on 60 years of denial. They are not psychologically able to do that. They cannot say we've been lying or we've been wrong, even worse for them to admit that we've been wrong for the past 50 or 60 years. And it's the same analogy, the same professional arrogance that dominates American archaeology. They cannot come out and say, well, we've been wrong for over 100 years, or we've been denying the evidence for over 100 years. Yes, because they look bad, or they think they look bad. But the fact nonetheless exists that the overwhelming burden of material forcing them to admit that, yes, there are evidences and proofs, to show that there were people here has had a telling effect on mainstream archaeology. And I don't believe that the history, the way it's being taught, I know that history, the way it's being taught today, will not be taught the same way. It will be taught radically 20 or more years from now.
All right, let's talk about, let me look at my clock. Yeah, we've got time to get into this before the next break. Let's talk about the existence of hard evidence. Now, you've been talking about the Edina and their skeletons. Here's the deal now with that, and then I'll move on. They could at least do a display in a museum with photographs of the remains.
Would be great.
Yeah. I think the fact that they don't do that shows that they still are chicken-hearted. And, and I'll go a step further. I know you don't really want to kick them in the teeth, but I don't mind. They have doctor's degrees, pensions, and tenure all developed on having, earned these doctorate degrees on what is fiction. And, if this material, if this information gets the broad light of day, so that we can see all the edges clearly, then they are clearly shown to be charlatans and frauds with their doctorate degrees in fiction.
Well, they also are dealing with dangerous information. This information we're talking about is dangerous.
Why?
Because there are Native American groups who, some of them, would be mortally offended.
So what?
The original Americans. And that now to claim that there are people from, say, Ireland or Japan that were here possibly even before their ancestors arrived, this is extremely upsetting.
So what?
So we're now venturing into the realm of political incorrectness, you see.
And again,
archaeologists have to maintain a very good rapport with Native Americans if they want to be able to go and study some of their work. There's already been a tremendous schism between Native Americans who are demanding more of their artifacts to be removed out of museums and returned for reburial on sacred land. And so here a maverick like myself comes up and says these things and rocks the boat even more at a time that such a disturbance is not welcome.
Well, again, I say, and I'm part Native American, but again, I say, so what? The facts are the facts. The data is the data. And, it's got to lead where it leads. And who cares who got here first?
Well, a lot of people do. You can go to foreign countries in the Americas in which Columbus is regarded as a saint. He's not officially canonized by the Vatican yet. For example, is in Brazil. About 22 years ago, a fellow by the name of Robert Marx was able to identify several ancient Roman wrecks off the coast of Rio de Janeiro. One of the wrecks that he found, he's a professional diver, one of the wrecks he found he retrieved an amphora, which is a kind of a storage jar. The storage jar amphora was sent to the University of Maine for analysis. They knew nothing about its origins, and they declared, quite obviously, that this was an amphora from ancient North Africa, Roman colony known as Mauritania, was shipped over about 40 or 41 A.D. When this information came out and Marx wanted to do more research on the wrecks, the church in Brazil made such a noise about it that they put pressure on the Brazilian Navy. The Brazilian Navy went out over the wreck site and dumped a cement barge over it. So it's impossible to have anything to do with that find. There are at least two, possibly three Roman wrecks that are completely covered with cement now.
So you're telling us then that the Roman Church is still in the business of enlightenment?
Well, they regard Columbus as a saint. And he is not only Columbus, but there were Portuguese sailors and so forth that found Brazil. And these things are...
Frank, we have to take a break, and we'll be back right after this, folks. Sorry, but it's got to happen. It happens whether we want it to or not, and we want to hear from these folks. So we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Frank Joseph. He is the editor-in-chief of a magazine called Ancient American. He is also the author of a new book that's out, and it's called Unearthing Ancient America. And I want to make something clear before we get back into our discussion. If I point out something that's an obvious fact, I'm not necessarily attacking anybody. I'm just pointing out a fact. If the fact hits you between the eyes, deal with the fact. It isn't a personality thing. Deal with the fact. And the fact is that there's a lot of evidence for lots of different civilizations having been here in America before Christopher Columbus. In fact, you know how he found America? He had maps. He had maps. Now, how did he have maps if someone hadn't been here? These are very well-known facts. But he was a great explorer, and apparently he was somewhat tyrannical as well. I mean, that's a fact. He got recalled to Spain and had to do a little time at the bottom of the totem pole because of his tyrannical behavior. But these are just facts. I am, Frank, I mentioned I'm part Native American. I'm part Cherokee. And I have a great deal of respect and reverence for the traditions of Native Americans. But if the facts, I mean, look, here's the deal. Even if we accept that America was populated by Asiatics who came across the land bridge, the fact is they came from somewhere to here. You know, when we say Native American, that's not true. They immigrated here. And, you know, everybody on this continent is an immigrant to this continent. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't have any regard or respect for Native Americans and Native American traditions. It just means that the facts are the facts.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing, Kevin. We have, in the years that we've published this magazine, have established a wonderful rapport with the vast majority of Native Americans that we've come into contact with. Very few have taken issue with us, and the reason for that is the exact opposite. As far as being in opposition to us, we've been helped and aided tremendously by numerous Native American tribes. And many of our subscribers are Native American. And the reason why is because they tell us we have these traditions. We have these oral histories of foreigners from various parts of our world, some light-skinned, some dark-skinned, who came here to be our friends, sometimes our enemies, but they impacted our way of life. We have told these stories to mainstream archaeologists for years, they tell us, and we've only been insulted by them because they say, oh, those are just fables, those things you just made up, they don't really have any bearing on real history. And that is, of course, one of the main points that we like to bring up in our magazine and that are showcased in our book, Unearthing Ancient America, is that there are these traditions amongst every Native American tribe, which tells about these foreigners that came to North America, what they call Turtle Island, long, long before Columbus ever showed up. Columbus was really just the last in a long series or chain of explorers who sometimes, as the book says, were castaways. Other times they were deliberate explorers or conquerors that came here. Their time came and went. And that Native Americans have known about this. They've preserved it wonderfully in their oral traditions. And that's what I think makes up a real important part of this question that we're examining. The thing that I like about Ancient American, and especially about Unearthing Ancient America, is that we offer very few theories. Instead, we present as much evidence as we can and let the reader determine for themselves what theories might be, how people came here, and if they came here. But some of the evidence is unimpeachable. And in one of the articles that we bring up in the book, we discuss the very latest DNA surveys, which were completed as recently as early this year, just before the book came out. As a matter of fact, we had time to update it. And this DNA survey was made of every Native American tribe in North America, including everybody north of the Rio Grande, including Canada, all the Canadian tribes. And the result of this DNA survey, this comprehensive survey that went on, I think, for about 5 or 6 years, has shown two things. It's shown that the mainstream archaeologists are right, and they are wrong. They are right. People did migrate out of Siberia about 13,000 years ago to become Native American tribes. However, the DNA evidence also shows conclusively that the same peoples, which we refer to as Native Americans today, intermarried with peoples from Western Europe, specifically and most prominently from Ireland and from Brittany, in other words, from France, the Atlantic areas of France, beginning thousands and thousands of years ago, perhaps as early as 9,000 years ago. The most amazing of all actually comes from Japan. The same DNA evidence, which we described, shows that an impact was made by immigrants from Japan by sea 20,000 years ago. 20,000 years ago. In other words, we're talking about 7,000 years before the tribes migrated, the peoples migrated out of Siberia. There were Japanese immigrants who had arrived on the shores of California, all up and down, as a matter of fact, the northwest coast, beginning 20,000 years ago. So it's an amazing story.
Well, having mentioned Japanese, let me jump over to the Grand Canyon. Now, the reason that I make that connection is because there is this story. It's fairly well documented, at least from newspaper accounts, that there was an ancient city found in the Grand Canyon, and that some of the artifacts appeared to be either Egyptian or Asian. What do you know about that?
Well, we had heard about this story for quite a few years, and we decided we would investigate it and see if it was fact or fiction. A number of materials come to us, of course, quite a few, which turn out to be false leads. That's fine. We track them down. This one, however, turned out to be something different. We did learn that there was a fellow by the name of Kincaid, and that this fellow was hired by the Smithsonian Institution to create a photographic record of the Grand Canyon. It had not happened before. We're talking about the year 1911. Mr. Kincaid, our research reveals, was in fact a professional nature photographer in the same stripe as Ansel Adams, and that he had been hired by the Smithsonian Institution years before to do other regional photographic surveys, mostly of California. Alone, in 1911, he set out in his boat with his photographic equipment and supplies down the Colorado River. And he did, in fact, complete the first photographic record of those reaches of the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon for the Smithsonian. About a third of his way into the Grand Canyon, he passed into an extremely remote area that was forbidden by Native American tribes. They regarded it as a cursed land, as a land of great evil. They would not go to this particular area, and it's understandable why, because it's very dangerous. As Kincaid is going through this area making his photographs, he's astounded to see a flight of steps that are carved into the side of a steep cliff. He's astounded because this area is so remote, he believes he's one of the first, if only, human beings that's ever been through this part of the Grand Canyon. He pulls his boat ashore. He ascends this broad flight of steps, which lead to the opening of a cavern, not a cave, but a cavern. He goes back to his boat, he brings a lantern, brings some photographic equipment, which he sets up outside, and he enters this cavern. He goes inside this cavern, and he sees what amounts to not only a city, but an underground city. He finds enormous rooms. One of the rooms appears to be a kind of a dormitory. the largest room of all strikes him as a like a kind of a cafeteria with long benches and stone chairs, tables. In another very large chamber, he finds stacks and stacks of weapons, bronze-edged weapons, spears, swords, shields. He removes, he touches nothing because he's a professional. He knows not to touch anything. In the cafeteria, he goes back there and finds stacks of plates, cups, great cauldrons, some of them made out of metal. He's not quite sure what they're made out of, bronze perhaps. In the in a corridor, it's honeycombed. This area is honeycombed with corridors that he finds. The most amazing discovery he made, however, was another large chamber, which was undoubtedly a religious area, a kind of a shrine. And in the center of this shrine is a round altar. At the base of the shrine are what he said were about 15 or 17 little statues, statuettes of demonic-looking creatures. On the altar itself, on the circular altar itself, was a large statue, fairly large, not a colossus, but about life-size, of a human figure, human-like figure. His description of it sounds either like the Egyptian god Bes, which was who was the god of enjoyment, of happiness, as a dwarf god, with his tongue sticking out, or else it could be a Hindu god related to possibly Kali, the goddess of death. It's difficult to tell from his description exactly what it was. Kincaid then proceeds with the rest of his assignment, and the newspapers are contacted because that's part of his agreement with the Smithsonian. He was to notify the newspapers that he had completed this. And in the interviews that were featured in the Arizona Gazette, is the main one, the Arizona Gazette, which is still in publication today, the Arizona Gazette features a front-page story of Kincaid in which he tells of this very bizarre discovery of this city or these carved rooms carved out of the native rock in the Grand Canyon. He then notifies his superiors at the Smithsonian. There's a fellow by the name of Jordan, J-O-R-D-A-N, who is sent out with an archaeological team from the Smithsonian in the year 1912 or possibly later in 1911. We're not sure, although we have some of the newspaper clippings from this, and that he and his archaeological team are taken by Kincaid back to the site, back up into the Grand Canyon, where they build a small railroad, and on this railroad they fill the cars with artifacts. They just almost gut the site. They fill it with cartloads of artifacts. These artifacts are then taken back by relays, boats, I guess, of course, that's the only way to go. And then a great iron door is installed over the cavern's mouth. Actually, it's two doors and padlocked and locked. And that's the end of the story. If you call the Smithsonian, as we did, we repeatedly called and talked to several people at the Smithsonian, and the directors there told us repeatedly that they had heard this story before, but they knew nothing about it. As far as they know, nobody by the name of Kincaid ever existed. The records show that nobody by the name of Jordan ever existed. End of story.
All right, we're going to get the rest of the story after this break. All right, folks, it gets curious, doesn't it? We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Frank Joseph. We're talking about ancient America. And Frank, when we went away for break, you were telling us about having contacted the Smithsonian, and they said in connection with this story about a lost city in the Grand Canyon, they knew nothing about it.
Right. I'll wrap this up. It can be pretty involved. I'll just cut to the chase on this. The Smithsonian denies that such a place ever existed. However, through our independent research, we not only did we verify that Kincaid really existed, I got a chance to talk to his grandson, who shared with me several volumes of photography that Kincaid made. Matter of fact, Kincaid is even, you can even find him on the Internet. Some of his early photography was rated rather highly. He's a minor photographer, but in his day he was regarded as a professional. The other fellow, Jordan, sent by the Smithsonian to do the second expedition, who the Smithsonian says also never existed, we found also several papers by him published by the Smithsonian back in 1926, about some years after all this adventure supposedly took place. So there appears to be no doubt whatsoever that this site was real. There also appears to be no doubt that the materials were probably destroyed and lost on purpose. The reason why is the Smithsonian is notorious for doing precisely that. Another story, I'll make this real quick. During World War II, there was a colonel who was in charge of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And while they were clearing an airstrip in the Aleutian Islands now, this is in the Alaska chain of Aleutian Islands, his bulldozers unearthed literally thousands of human skulls. Thousands of skulls. Matter of fact, the GIs picked them up and used them as candle holders and bookends and things like that. He had couldn't understand where all these skulls came from, so he collected some himself, and he sent several of these skulls and also some other human bones along with these skulls to the Smithsonian. Actually, it was the thing to do in 1945. The Smithsonian sent him back saying, "We are in receipt of your materials, and we're looking at them. They're very interesting." They also wrote back to him before the war ended, war was still on, that the skulls that he had sent to them all belonged to people who came from the Yucatan and were associated with the ancient Mayas. Ancient Mayas in Alaska? So he was intrigued in this. Of course, he had other things to do at the time. His duties were more pressing. And after the war, very shortly after, about 1947 or so, he went back to the Smithsonian and said, "Well, what other information have you been able to unearth on these skulls?" And they asked him, "What skulls are you talking about? We didn't receive anything from you at all." He showed them the receipt. They said, "Oh, that material has all been lost. We don't have any of that whatsoever." There's other instances, but that's among the most documented instance where the Smithsonian conveniently loses materials which fly in the face of accepted paradigms for our understanding of the past. And this, I have no doubt that that city in the Grand Canyon exists. We do know where it is, generally speaking, not exactly. It is in an area that is forbidden by the Park Service. The Park Service forbids people from going in there because they say, probably rightly, that it's very dangerous and that they do not have the facilities to rescue anybody in there. So you cannot go there unless you have a permit. Try to get a permit. You won't get one. So it's something that needs to be explored by professionals. I wouldn't urge anybody to go there looking for it, although people do look for it from time to time. They're not allowed to be in that area. And it's only one example of how we are cut off from those great forces which impacted our prehistory, our roots.
You know, I've had a guest on this show who is an explorer, and he has shared with us a lot of the same information, not entirely the same, but a lot of the same information that you've just told us. And I was glad to hear you say about the railroad, because he and his wife have found out where that railroad is, the remains of it. And they sent, I didn't know about this being a forbidden area. He may have mentioned that, but I don't recall. But they sent some climbers over the edge and found the entrance to the cave. And so, you know, the parts of the story that can be verified seem to have been verified.
I wonder if this is the same couple that contacted us some years ago, where they were saying, yes, they found the site. They did find the railroad tracks that were installed, and the iron gates are still there, still locked up. So
it may be. After the show, I'll give you the contact information after the show, and
well,
you guys can can maybe get together on that. All right, but now it's pretty interesting. The Smithsonian says, well, we have no record that there was a Kincaid working for us, and we have no record that we had an archaeologist named Jordan that was ever affiliated with us. And you found papers published by the Smithsonian.
Yes.
By Jordan.
Didn't even take that much work to find it.
Do you think they simply don't know what they've got?
It's a kind of a selective amnesia. When things like this are pointed out to them, they take no interest in it at all. Says, oh, well, that's... In fact, we did return to them. Matter of fact, I remember now, because this article came out some years ago, that I sent them copies of the front piece for Jordan's paper that he had published with the Smithsonian in 1926, and they were very grateful. Yes, thank you very much. And that's about it, as far as it goes.
Yeah.
So these are the people that write our history now. That's the scary part, of course. Has anything changed since then? Has there been another Smithsonian expedition to try to find this place, or any interest in it at all? Are you going to see this on TV, on the news? No, you're not. Everything is pretty much homogenized out of existence.
Does it make a big difference to know the real history?
It makes an enormous difference to know the real history.
Why is that?
Because what else have we got? The history of America, that's our story. And the reason why we are in such trouble today is because Americans do not have a sense of history. And history is the great teacher. Not history teachers. History of people that are well-versed, that are rooted in a sense of their history, are great. Look at the ancient Greeks. They were very conscious of their roots and their history. They went through the golden age that is the foundation of Western civilization. We are in trouble today because we cannot make the parallels between what's happening now and what has happened in the past. What's happened in the past, there is no difference, really, between past, present, and future. There are forces which are at work from the past, which are working right in our society today and will go on beyond our time. We cannot understand what's happening to us today. People say, what has happened? How can the economy fall like a house of cards? That's because whenever anybody says that, they have absolutely no concept of what has happened before. And I don't mean just in 1929. That's about as far as most Americans go now. And what we are suffering from today is a lack of history, a lack of a sense of history. This stuff isn't just interesting or something for enthusiasts. It is a failure of the American educational system that it is not impressed upon the young people, especially, who have now grown up, with a sense of our own past. We think we are, because we have atomic bombs and refrigerators, that we're better and beyond the laws of history for anybody else.
Well, you know, our educational system doesn't even get into much information about the Native Americans who were standing on the shore waving when Columbus rolled up.
Well, at least, and this is where I hope that our book makes a small contribution in the right direction, it shows that civilization does not begin with the United States of North America. That civilizations as splendid as ours, magnificent, far longer-lived than ours, rose and fell. If that's the case, and it is, why did these civilizations fall? Why did they think that they were so impervious to the same forces that destroyed civilizations before them and civilizations after? That's the great utility of the past. It isn't just something neat or a collection of useless dates. History is filled with blood and sweat and human activity. That's the only thing that makes history worthwhile and vibrant. And that's the great root of our distress today.
What about, I'll have to hold this question because we're racing towards a break. When we come back, I want us to get into indications of the Norsemen having been here and hard evidence for them, the Egyptians. And then we'll open the telephone lines and allow folks to call in and talk with us and ask questions or make comments. And but we'll do that when we come back from the break that is upon us. All right, folks, Frank Joseph and Unearthing Ancient America. More of it when we come back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Frank Joseph. Now, in just a moment, I'm going to open the telephone lines, and when I do open the telephone lines, the telephone number is 602-539-9580. It's not open yet, but when I open the lines, 602-539-9580. If you live outside of the United States or you live outside of Canada, we have something called Flash Message. Just go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down. You'll see the little blurb about tonight's show. And below it, you'll see a link that says Flash Message. Now, you have to be outside of the USA. You have to be outside of Canada to use that. Why? Because in the USA and Canada, that number is not expensive to call, and many of you actually have free minutes on your cell phones, or on you have Vonage, or you've got some sort of system where it doesn't cost you anything to call us. So 602-539-9580. Frank, when we went away, I said I'd like for us to talk about evidence that the Norsemen were here. And when were they here? And you talk about that in your book. You have that in your book. So tell us a little about that.
Well, one of the most interesting articles, I think, in Unearthing Ancient America has to do with a tremendous breakthrough on a stone that was found in 1898. It was found in Minnesota, about 200 miles west of the Twin Cities. It's known as the Kensington Rune Stone. It was unearthed by a farmer while he was clearing his land. The stone was found in the roots of an old tree, so obviously it went back quite a ways. And this granite boulder was inscribed on three sides with a runic script. And the runic script was fairly easily translated, even in his day. And this script told about an expedition of Norsemen. These were not Vikings. This was after the Viking Age had ended. The Viking Age came to a close around 1200 A.D. at the very latest. However, the Norse, well, they still exist today, of course, in Scandinavia, and the Norse were, of course, great sailors, and they still possessed their Viking boats. And the Norse indicated on this inscription that was found in Minnesota that a Norse expedition from Sweden of about 50 men arrived here in 1361 A.D., and that they got into a skirmish with Native Americans. Some of the Norse were killed, and that the stone was set up as a memorial to those that had been that had fallen in the altercation with Native American tribes. Well, the stone was immediately pounced upon by mainstream archaeologists, even back then in the 19th century, as a fraud, as a fake, and has been the center of controversy ever since then, with some people arguing that it's authentic and others saying, no, it's, especially the mainstream archaeologists, that it's just a fraud. Well, that's all been put to rest now, because the article that was written by Scott Walter, who is a professional university-trained geologist, was able to examine this boulder and the runic inscription with electron microscope and was able to find tool marks that were made by a medieval method, and that he was able to satisfactorily date this stone back to the 14th century just exactly when the inscription was carved. Now, you're not going to see that on the evening news, and they're not going to have any specials about it on television, unfortunately. But nonetheless, the fact remains that Scott Walter, is the fellow's name, is a professional geologist, and through the use of the most modern technology has been able to authenticate this stone. It is hard evidence that there were Norse here long before Columbus set sail, before Columbus was born, obviously, set sail from Spain to so-called discover the New World.
You know, one of the big, big problems that these guys have, the status quo, the establishment scientist, one of the big, big problems they have, and I don't think they're bright enough to see this, is that whenever they defend the status quo against hard data, and they continue to say, well, I just don't buy that. I think that's, you know, that one's a hoax. And they just debunk. They make themselves to be unbelievable. And by making themselves to be unbelievable, they open up the door for actual hoaxes to get through.
Ooh, yeah, that's right.
And, you know, by not doing good hard science and just letting the data say what the data says, they open the door to lots of hoaxes getting through. Because, look, there are certain institutions that if they come out and say the sky is blue, I'll go check it first before I buy the story. And there are a lot of folks in that boat, lots of folks, because we know not to believe them. They've lied so much and been caught so often. And they really need to get a grip on reality and let the evidence just say what it says. All right, very quickly, tell us about evidence for the Egyptians having been here.
Oh, well, that's very interesting, too. There is a huge amount of evidence for an Egyptian impact that was made in the ancient times. And just to begin, I think, with a couple of interesting cognates. Cognates are words in different languages that are very similar, and not only in the way they sound, but what they mean. For example, the Egyptian word for gold is no'ub. The Maya word for gold is na'ab. The Egyptian word for copper is hempti, or hampti, actually, hampti. And the Maya word for copper is hamatan. Well, believe me, I could go on all evening listing all the cognates between ancient Mayan language and ancient Egyptian. But probably the most impressive of all is another collection of huge evidence in the mummies that were beginning to be examined in the early 1990s, when some of the Egyptologists noticed some strange things about the Egyptian mummies that dated from about 1,000 B.C., even going back earlier than that, as far back as 2,000 B.C., spreading over a period of 1,000 years. So we're talking about dozens, hundreds of mummies. And these mummies that were examined and re-examined by Egyptologists were found to contain huge amounts of cocaine and tobacco, but mostly cocaine. Cocaine does not grow anywhere in North Africa. In Africa at all, not in, let alone in Egypt. The cocaine was traced directly to the highlands of Peru and Bolivia. This shows that there was an active cocaine trade going on between ancient Egypt and the pre-Inca peoples of Peru and Bolivia, South America. Cocaine was used not for recreational purposes, as they call it today, was used for religious purposes to achieve altered states of consciousness. And the existence of the cocaine mummies, hundreds of them, indicates that there is no doubt that there was a lively trade going on between the North America, Egyptian North Africa, and South America.
You know, I believe this belongs to the Inca, the god Quetzalcoatl.
Quetzalcoatl, he was known by a different name amongst the Inca. They called him Cuntiqui Viracocha.
Yeah, and it was the Aztec that called him Quetzalcoatl, yeah.
Yeah, Quetzalcoatl was the Aztec man god, very similar. This man god, he's always described as tall, fair-haired, light-skinned. As a matter of fact, there's a poem that the Aztecs wrote about Quetzalcoatl, and they say that his beard looks like straw, like yellow straw. Well, that's interesting because not only were the Aztecs not fair-haired, but they also didn't grow facial hair. So here they're talking about a bearded foreigner who's bringing all this high technology, described as magic, of course, in this poem. And the same figure was known to the Incas. They called him Contiki Viracocha, or Sea Foam, also described as a tall, in this case, a red-haired fellow who brings all this high technology that begins Inca and pre-Inca civilization. So, obviously, these are references to foreigners who possessed a different technology that was appreciated in the New World.
I read a book that said that he shows up, the first time that he shows up, in Central and South America was at approximately the same time that Thoth was exiled from Egypt. And his sacred number, which I'm not sure what sacred numbers are all about, but his sacred number happened to be the same as the sacred number for Thoth. And so there was some speculation about, you know, maybe it's the same person.
Well, it isn't. I think it's wrong to say it's the same person. I think that this god figure, whether you call him Thoth or Thoth or Quetzalcoatl or Contiki Viracocha, they represent a people. He personifies, this god personifies a people that is incoming. And it is correct that the arrival of Thoth, his exile not from Egypt, but his exile from a place called Sekhret Aru, this was Thoth's kingdom, which sank into the sea. This is according to Egyptian tradition, that after Thoth lost his kingdom called Sekhret Aru, he arrived in a solar boat at the Nile Delta. Now, that's interesting because Egyptian civilization begins 3100 B.C. That's the first dynasty. On the other side of the world, they talk about Quetzalcoatl, or the feathered serpent, arriving after he lost his kingdom in the sea. They called it Aztlan, A-Z-T-L-A-N, and that the beginning date of the Maya calendar is August 14th, 3111 B.C. So we're talking about the same, precisely the same time period that these bearers of a high culture are arriving in ancient Egypt and in Mexico at the same time, precisely the same period of time. We have it in the Maya calendar. So I think what we're talking about is not a single individual. We're rather talking about a metaphor in the person of a hero god or a hero who is made to identify with this people coming in.
All right. I want to open up the telephone lines and see what our audience may have for us here this evening. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Okay, Kevin?
Hello, Mr. Joseph. How are you doing?
I'm very fine. Thank you for calling.
Yes,
just one moment, Kevin. Hang on. Let's. I don't have good audio on you. Hang on. All right, now we'll try it.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Oh, all right. All right, Mr. Joseph. Have you heard long before Christopher Columbus landed in the Americas, the Vikings landed in Newfoundland, Canada, long before, and that's even taught in our textbooks. Now, I don't know if it's taught in the textbooks down in the States, but if we learned in school that, yes, that Christopher Columbus was no longer the first person to have discovered America, that the Vikings actually had a settlement in Newfoundland way back in the day. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Wonderful that Canadian education has risen above the low level that unfortunately still appertains in our country, because that has been known for about 30 years now. There's a place called Lance Meadows, and Lance Meadows was a settlement that the Vikings established about 1000 A.D., and that this settlement, Lance Meadows in Labrador, was used as an outpost for discovering other parts of North America. Now, archaeologists, even today, have to admit, and they do admit, that yes, okay, the Vikings did land at Lance of Meadows, but that's as far as they got, and it really wasn't very important. They were there a short time and left. But apparently, the Canadian educational authorities know better, and it's wonderful that they're imparting this superior knowledge to their students that, yes, the Vikings were the first in North America, first recorded Western Europeans to have arrived in North America. And Lance of Meadows probably is associated with their Vinland, which is described in the Viking sagas. So to know the Canadians are ahead of us.
Well, it's not, and on the west coast of Canada, they've also found some ancient Chinese coins in western Canada. Archaeologists have found it, indicating that the Chinese have also voyaged to Canada long ago, way back in the day. I didn't learn that in school. That's something else I read in an archaeology textbook. I was actually looking on stuff on the giants, and I heard about this, and said they found these ancient Chinese coins.
There's a very excellent book that you can read about that. It's called Pale Ink, and it was written by a lady by the name of Henrietta Mertz. I don't know if that book is still in publication, but you can definitely get it at your library. It was a very popular book in its day in the 1970s. And Pale Ink describes in great detail the Chinese expeditions that landed in British Columbia and that left not only numerous coins behind, but also traditions amongst the Native Americans, especially the Haida Indians who talk about the Chinese, the impact made on the Native American peoples, the Gitxgan and so forth by Chinese explorers in British Columbia is beyond question.
Kevin, thanks for the call, man. We appreciate it. All right, folks, the telephone number is on your screen if you happen to be watching our internet television channel. And if you are listening via radio or cell phone or computer, the telephone number is 602-539-9580. 602-539-9580. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, this is Trey from Louisiana.
Hi, Trey.
Hey, let me to find out that we've got history wrong and all kind of things wrong. That's not really too surprising. But let me ask you this: what is the most surprising or amazing thing that you found out, either about technologies or things that older cultures had that we don't know about that made you say, "Wow, I didn't figure they had that."
Well, it's fortuitous that you're calling from Louisiana, you say?
Yes, sir.
Well, in the northeast part of your state is the oldest city in North America. It's called Poverty Point. It's an archaeological park. It exists today. You can go there and see it. And in the year 1500 BC, 15 centuries before Christ, this great city just erupted out of nowhere. Shows no precursors, no early development. Just a population that long ago in the Bronze Age showed up and made this fabulous city. It's unlike any other city seen in North America before or since. Well, there weren't any before, certainly since. This city is made up of concentric lines or concentric mounds that alternated with water courses. So if you looked at it from the air, and it was only discovered from the air as recently as the 1950s, you would see what appears to be a gigantic target where you have these alternating artificial islands connected by a series of canals. And it was a marvelous place. They had trade as far as the Rocky Mountains into the Gulf of Mexico, and they were great manufacturers of crystal. They created thousands of crystal objects that mostly resembled owls. So you can go to the city today. It existed from about 1500 B.C., it went through a population surge about 1200 B.C., about 300 years later, where there were as many as perhaps 20,000 or more people living there. And then a few centuries later, they, for some reason, completely abandoned the area. So that place is a real wow. It's America's oldest city. Who created it? Obviously, somebody in possession of weights and measures and surveying, distribution of labor and so forth. Just a marvelous, great place. Doesn't require any theory. You can just go there and see it yourself.
Oh, huh. Well, that's amazing. And I have seen that off of I-20, Poverty Point. I couldn't tell you where, but it's right off of I-20 somewhere. So.
Well, anyway, thanks for taking my call.
All right, thanks for the call, Trey. You were saying, Frank?
Well, I'd say Poverty Point is easy enough to find, and it's just a remarkable site. It bears nothing culturally in common with the very few Native Americans, known as Archaeo-Indians at that time, who inhabited that area of the state.
All right, the telephone line is 602-539-9580, 602-539-9580. If you have a question or a comment for Frank Joseph, maybe there is something in your part of the country that is very ancient, and no one really talks about it. It's not taught in school, but you know about it. We'd love to hear from you. Again, 602-539-9580 is the telephone number, and we'll take your calls. Frank, what you talked about the DNA. What possibility is there that that DNA was mixed across the water before it got here?
Well, that's the whole idea behind this DNA survey, is that these DNA traces indicate, especially from Western Europe and Japan, that intermarriages were taking place at this time. We're talking about 3,000 years ago, and that about the same time that the Edina got started, we talked about them earlier, these giants, that's the same time that we see a massive population influx from Ireland and Brittany. That's very interesting. The DNA is telling us that there were people from France and Ireland specifically who came in large numbers to North America. That's the same time the Edina got started. Now, if you look at the Edina, a lot of these guys were seven-footers. You know who also were seven-footers at that same time? The Celts. And the Celts were a people who fought Rome at this time, or shortly thereafter, and they were also great seafarers. They made huge ships that actually were larger than anything that the Vikings sailed. And the Celts were magnificent seamen. So it would appear that there was a great migration of Celtic peoples who left Ireland and France and settled here in North America to create what the archaeologists call the Edina.
I just got an email from someone. I can't believe this. Wanting to know, they said, I see you drink from a coffee cup every night. What is that? It's coffee. It's just coffee, folks. Believe me. Turkish coffee, but it's coffee. What about, but that makes me think of something relative to what we're discussing, Frank. What about traces of food and recipes and that sort of thing that show up here in ancient America that are not native to America?
Well, some of the interesting things are as simple as chicken bones. One of our articles in Unearthing Ancient America talks about these chicken bones that were found throughout Polynesia and also along the coasts of Chile and Peru. Now, what's interesting about these very minor objects, that these chicken bones indicate a species that was not native to either Polynesia or South America. And as a matter of fact, the chicken bones are quite easily traced back to a variety of poultry that was bred and raised in Imperial China about 700 A.D., between 700 A.D. and 900 A.D. So these are the food remains that were left behind by the Chinese as incontrovertible evidence, spread all the way across the Pacific, all through Polynesia, and ended up on the shores of Chile and Peru. So archaeologists have a very difficult time with even minor evidence like this. But again, chicken bones, which, by the way, are all dated to this period we're talking about.
Hey, we have to take a break. Folks, we'll be back. The telephone line is open for you. All right? 602-539-9580, and we shall return right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I am Kevin Smith, your host, and we are talking this evening with Frank Joseph. He is the editor-in-chief of Ancient American, and he is the author of a book called Unearthing Ancient America. You know, one of the things that I haven't asked you, and I'd like to know, are you so interested, and what got you interested in this topic of ancient America?
Well, we go back to our education again. I just, it did not sit right with me. I felt that there were too many inexplicable problems with the party line, as it were, that was told to me. And so very slowly on my own, I began looking around at alternate sources. And it took me quite a few years before I finally realized that we had actually been sold a terrible bill of goods with this Columbus fraud. And I suppose it was a slow process over time. I'd say mostly it was, to answer your question, is a dissatisfaction with the apparent inadequacy of our education that pointed me in this direction.
Frank, the oldest civilizations in the Americas, are they not in Central and South America?
Yes, they are. But this doesn't take away, really, from anything that's happened north of the Rio Grande. It's very difficult to tell, really, what is the oldest civilization, because archaeologists are finding new sites all the time that push the origins of civilization in the Americas back further and further. It's now known, for example, that there were cities along the coast of Peru at the same time that Egypt was new, had just started, or the civilization began to flourish in Mesopotamia. The same impetus, the same building of pyramids and ceremonial centers was taking place in the what is now the desert of Peru. It was not a desert area back then. So the origins of civilization get older all the time. The oldest known city, as I told this gentleman earlier, is in North America. It goes back really quite far. Egypt was flourishing as a great kingdom back in 1500 BC, and that's just when Poverty Point was flourishing in Louisiana. So you don't have to go to the outside world to see great antiquities. They're certainly right here in our own country, our own continent.
So when we talk about this as being the New World, it really wasn't.
Well, it was new to people of Columbus's day, I'm sure. We have to understand that all of these great discoveries that were made by the ancients, whether they're the Celts from Ireland or the ancient Egyptians, that all those great discoveries were lost when a dark age descended on the Roman world. When Rome fell, civilization, the lamp of civilization went out. It's known as the Dark Ages, with good reason. For 500 years, there was no literacy. People had abandoned all of the high achievements that had been piled up for thousands of years before. So all these things were forgotten and needed to be rediscovered. And in a way, of course, we can't take that away from Columbus. He, in effect, rediscovered what others had found and had since been lost and forgotten.
So, where did he get his maps?
That's a wonderful article by Professor Gunnar Thompson. His own story is worth retelling. I won't get into it. It takes too long. But Gunnar Thompson is a university-trained archaeologist. And when he began to notice that there were too many problems with the establishment line, he was literally thrown out of his office. He was no longer allowed to teach or to work as a university scholar. So he's now an independent or a maverick scholar. And in his article, he tells us how Christopher Columbus had a set of maps that he received from the Portuguese, who had visited North America for 10 or 15 years before he set sail in 1492. In other words, even at the close, before the close of the 15th century, the Portuguese were regularly visiting and charting, making maps of North America. And it was these maps that decided him that he could undertake this voyage. The Portuguese had kept it relatively secret because they wanted to have private access to some of the minerals
mineral deposits that they were laying their hands on in North America. It's also known that before Columbus, fishermen, Basque fishermen, were regularly going out to Labrador to catch certain types of fish that they could not find in European waters. This also is about 10 or 15 years before Columbus got going. And Gunnar Thompson very clearly and adequately documents how Columbus had these maps thanks to the Portuguese. So his so-called discovery had really even been made in his own time by fellow Iberians, in this case navigators from Lisbon.
The Portuguese, how did they know that they would not fall off the edge of the world?
Well, nobody believed that at that time. The idea that the world was flat, I have no idea how that evolved, because the scholars of their day did not believe that the world was flat. The only thing I can think of is that some churchmen probably believed that and some uneducated people, but the navigators of Columbus's day knew that the world was spherical. They had the work still preserved of Eratosthenes, who was the Greek scholar whose work did survive the fall of Rome, and he, of course, proved that the world was not a flat disc. It was, in fact, spherical. His experiments, his simple experiments with a stick in a well and watching the shadow, proved that the Earth was a sphere. And so Columbus knew that the world was spherical, and they understood the basic principles involved. So that was not the issue. But it is an interesting question that you bring up. How did the Portuguese know about it? Well, this indicates that a lot of people had been going back and forth between Europe and America, and the Portuguese were some of them. I would say that the Portuguese got it from the Templars. The Templars, the Scots Rites of Templars, there's a fellow by the name of Sinclair. And Sinclair and his Templar fleet certainly made it across, part of the Templar fleet certainly made it across North America and interacted with the Native Americans here. We have an article on that subject as well. So if you go back further and further, one group found out from the other. It was just a political maneuver on the part of the Portuguese to keep the thing silent, and Columbus blew it wide open by declaring it all for Spain. And because Spain was a greater military power, the Portuguese could not challenge it. All this is brought out in Gunnar Thompson's wonderful article, which shows that here's Columbus finding his way across the Atlantic with these maps that had been prepared for him by the Portuguese. Remarkable.
All right, now
you won't read it, and you won't hear this story taught in your class, obviously.
Well, I certainly never heard it in class. I have read it. I have heard it from publications like yours. But, you know, if you keep going back far enough, you got to get to who were the first ones as far as we know. So,
well, the first ones, as far as we know, were probably a group of people the archaeologists first referred to as the Red Paint People. And the Red Paint People were great seafarers. We have no idea who they were. They were Europeans. They're called Red Paint People, not because they had red paint, but because they used a bright red or orange ochre, which they used in their burial rituals. And this red paint ochre that was used by the Red Paint People is found all over Norway and parts of Germany, Normandy, and parts of Britain. And we find this exact same evidence along the shores of New England, and they're associated with the same type of domiciles, whale bone structures, and so forth. So, and these people go back 7,000 years ago. So they're not the first either, though, because the earliest known foreigners to North America are a white people, a Caucasian people. They're associated with the skeleton that was found in Kennewick, Washington, about 18 years ago, 17 or 18 years ago. This is the skeleton that was found, belongs to a Caucasian man who was killed. They first thought, when they found the skeleton, that it was a murder victim. Well, it was a murder victim, but it goes back 9 or 11,000 years ago. And he represents a people that have nothing whatsoever genetically to do with any Native American tribe. He belongs to a lost white race that is associated with people known as the Ainu in Japan. Well, I'm not going to get too complex here, but nonetheless, here is a fellow that is who has the physical evidence of his very well-preserved skeletal remains indicating that there was a population of Caucasians who were inhabiting the Pacific Northwest 9 to 11,000 years ago. His skeleton is not the only one that's been found. There have been, I think, about a dozen or so, other, not quite a dozen or so, other related Caucasian skeletons that are found all across as far as North Dakota from into Montana that belong to the same group. Interestingly enough, all of these skeletal remains of this lost white people were all suffered trauma, lethal trauma. So there appears to have been a war of extermination going on a very long time ago, and that's why we don't know anything about these people anymore except for their bones.
Well, that gives rise. You've heard of the movie White Men Can't Jump?
I've heard of it. I don't know anything about it.
Well, that would give rise to a whole new view of history. White men can't fight.
Oh, well, they maybe were overwhelmed. Like the Vikings were probably the best fighters in history, but they couldn't make an impact that they couldn't stay in North America too long because you have a whole continent of Native Americans that you have to fight, and you only have a few hundred Vikings at a time. It was only through the introduction of gunpowder and modern weaponry that Europeans could get a foothold in this country. If it hadn't been for firearms, Columbus and his people and the people that followed him would never have been able to stay here because they're just terribly outnumbered.
All right, now these red paint people. You said we don't really know much about them. Did they build towns? Were they just sort of hunters gatherers? What were they?
They appeared to be like a whaling folk. They were great seafarers. No, they were not what you would call civilized in the sense that they had cities and written language and plumbing and things like that. But the red paint people appear to be were chasing whales around the Arctic, and they're related to people known in the Orkneys, where they built the wonderful little towns, little hamlets, I suppose, little stone hamlets, and also they used a lot of whale bone. But they were like a tribe, I would suppose, a large tribe that were always on the move. You call them sort of hunter-gatherers, only they were on the sea. That's where they did their hunting and gathering.
All right, who were the first people, I think you said the first city in America is at Poverty Point. Is there any indication? I mean, do we have any pottery? Do we have any tools? Do we have any artifacts left from those people?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, you can go to the Poverty Point Museum today, and they have quite a few artifacts. Although it's a peculiar thing because the inhabitants of Poverty Point, whoever they were, they abandoned that whole city. They picked up everything, tooth and nail, and left. A few things have been found, mostly these little carvings of crystal owls.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll get into that when we come back. Folks, the telephone number is 602-539-9580. We'll take your calls when we come back. All right, we're back. We're on Final Approach. I will take one telephone call between now and the end of the show. If you've been thinking of calling, you have a question or a comment, now is the time. 602-539-9580 is the number. Frank, we were talking about Poverty Point, and you said this is the oldest city in America. How do we know it was a city?
Well, it was laid out on an urban scale. Archaeologists have been able to determine that its population was around 20,000. Some archaeologists say it's less than that. Also, trade items have been found in large numbers from various parts of North America, indicating an active commercial network. Land management was excelled only by the water management at Poverty Point. There appears to have been knowledge of sluice gates. There was management of the Arkansas River that went through part of this city. So everything about Poverty Point indicates a subtle population of farmers and astronomers. That's the other thing, too. The central plaza of Poverty Point featured a number of solar orientations and alignments that marked the solstices that were involved in the passage of the seasons. So it's apparently an agricultural city. That's the best way, I suppose, to describe it.
All right. Now, you said that they had found some of the artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things they found?
Well, the very few things they did find, relatively few, were mostly agricultural utensils, digging sticks. Pottery was not very outstanding. It was mostly utilitarian, pretty much like our civilization, if our civilization was somehow to end very abruptly. Mostly what people would find would be day-to-day goods. However, they did find a few outstanding things, quite a few, actually. If you go to Poverty Point Museum today, they have a large barrel that's filled with what must be thousands of these little crystal carvings of owls. They're maybe about 2 or 3 inches long, and apparently this was one of their prime symbols, was the owl, which makes a great deal of sense. The owl was also a very important figure in Egyptian religion, not because it's a wise old owl, but because the owl has the ability to see through the darkness. And therefore, the owl was, to the Egyptians, a symbol of enlightenment, darkness being associated with ignorance. And so to be able to see through the darkness would be someone who is far-sighted. And therefore, the owl became a kind of iconic figure for spiritual illumination or enlightenment. Now, we don't know that meant the same thing to the people of Poverty Point, but it is interesting that they chose to memorialize this particular animal over and over again in crystal. So there you are.
But we don't know why.
No, they left no written records behind. But we do know that it must have been important to them, otherwise they wouldn't have gone to the lengths of making so many of these eagles. They also created an interesting mound, which I believe is, I'm going to say 100 feet, but I'm probably wrong at that, probably a lot less than that, but maybe originally it was close to 100 feet. It's a large conical mound on the north end of Poverty Point, and the top of it is scooped out to create a crater, so the entire mound looks like a volcano, and it probably looked a lot more like a volcano when it was in use, because that crater at the top of this mound was used for cremation. They used to create cane fires, very, very hot. They did not bury their dead. There are no burials at Poverty Point whatsoever, at least no burials that are associated with the creators, the builders, the inhabitants of Poverty Point. They cremated their dead. That also is very non-Native American. We're mostly involved in sky burials on scaffolds. But here the people were involved in cremation, which is a very European way of disposing of the dead.
So what do you suspect? You suspect that they were European?
Well, I more than suspect that. Now we're getting into what is referred to as fantastic archaeology, but it's nonetheless something that has occupied my thinking a lot for the last 28 years. If you look at Poverty Point, what city does it resemble? It resembles only one place. And you have to go to a philosopher by the name of Plato, who about 400 years before Christ caused to be made a dialogue known as the Critias, and another one is the Timaeus. And in both of these dialogues, he describes a place set out in the Atlantic Ocean made up of alternating water and land courses. And it looks like a great target seen from the air. And he named this place Atlantis. Now, what's interesting is that the destruction of Atlantis parallels the population surge that took place at Poverty Point. So that's another question, I suppose. But I think they were from Atlantis. I think they were Atlantean. I think Atlantis was a real place that actually existed. It's not mentioned in our book. The A word is not mentioned in Unearthing Ancient America, but I've written other books on the subject. And I think Poverty Point was made by people from Atlantis when that city collapsed into the sea about 3,200 years ago.
Okay, so what made these folks just pick up and move?
Don't know. Don't have a clue. Perhaps population pressures from Native Americans, don't know, or some climate change, or maybe the agriculture gave out, have no idea. But around 800 B.C., they evacuated. There's no indication of war or disease, so maybe those two suppositions are not valid. For some reason, they left, and the place was overgrown and abandoned and unknown for hundreds of years thereafter. It was only discovered, I believe, 1956 by an accidental aerial survey.
It's pretty interesting that they just picked up and moved, just vanished, and we don't find signs of that civilization reestablishing itself anywhere.
No.
And
so
then
what
you have
that happened with these people is that they were absorbed by the native population. They intermarried, interbred with them, and adopted the ways of the native culture. There are, however, other cities, ancient cities, in which this something very similar has taken place, where an entire population gets up and moves and leaves.
Yeah.
Another place like that is in Illinois. We discussed that a little bit in Unearthing Ancient America. Right across the Mississippi River from St. Louis is a place called Cahokia, and that place flourished. They created at Cahokia an enormous city of about 100,000 people. We're talking about an enormous metropolis. A minimum of 30,000 people inhabited Cahokia, but it looks like three times that amount actually lived in the area. And they made a pyramid there. You can visit it today. Its base is greater than the Great Pyramid of Egypt. It's 14 square acres. Egypt's is 13 square acres. This pyramid, although it's made out of earth, is a magnificent pyramid. And that people arose very suddenly in 900 A.D. and inhabited that area for just two centuries and left abruptly in 1100 A.D.
And we don't know why.
The only speculation, I've written about that to some degree, and it is speculation, I try to stay away from it for the most part, but you strive for answers. It appears that these people at Cahokia left voluntarily in accordance with their ritual calendar, that they had really one god, the god of time, and the god of time told them it was time to leave. That appears to be a possibility, although we do not know for sure. They also left no written records behind.
Frank, we're out of time. Thank you for being with us, and if you will, stay on the line with me for a moment.
My pleasure.
All right, folks, there you have it, Unearthing Ancient America. There's a link on my website that will take you over to Frank's website. It's right beside his picture, so KevinSmithShow.com. If you haven't become a member yet, become a member tonight, all right? My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.